Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
And I'm Gontran Wolf.
And I'm Maria de Mertis.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. And as the world continues to grapple with the multiple outbreaks of the coronavirus, we're going to be discussing the economic impact and the differences between policy-making approaches as we go through this crisis or the reaction to this crisis. So, Gontran, everyone knows this is a medical issue. Everybody knows by now that they should be washing their hands for at least 20 seconds. But why is this also an economic issue?
Well, I think the first point really to make, this is first and foremost a health issue, and it has to be treated and dealt with as a health issue. So in other words, the epidemiologists and the health experts, they should be in charge, really. And they should really make sure that appropriate care can be given to all those that need care. And I think that's where the economics comes in. I think we are seeing now that as the virus spreads very quickly, more and more people need very quickly treatment. And as they need treatment, hospital beds are in short supply, equipment is in short supply, doctors are in short supply. And so one of the big debates now and one of the big questions for policymakers is now, how do you reduce the speed of the spread of the virus, right? I mean, the virus is spreading. The curves are exponential, so the number of cases are going up like crazy in many, many EU countries. It's everywhere now. So I think most people agree that it's my understanding that it cannot be contained because there's just too many people that have it. But the speed of the spread can be reduced. And as you do that, basically the basic measures for this is basically reducing social contacts, right? I mean, reducing school contacts, reducing metro, reducing activities, increased teleworking, and so on and so forth. And as we know, these things actually matter economically, because our economic system, to explain in very simple terms, a large part of our economic system is really the services sector, and a lot in the services sector is actually about meeting people, going in a restaurant, being in a bar. So basically it's about the social contact. And if you reduce that, you reduce the speed, but it has an economic impact. It has an economic impact in terms of supply. So the supply is less because people can't work, but it also has an impact on demand, because basically people that don't make a salary anymore, independent workers that don't make a salary anymore, they cannot also consume new goods. And so this has basically therefore a strong effect on the economy.
And just to give an example, actually, on one of the things that Gontran was talking about, Professor Simon Renault-Lewis in the UK had done a very interesting study about 10 years ago, I think, where he used his economic tools to try and quantify the effects of a pandemic. It wasn't particularly about the coronavirus, but about pandemics. And amongst many things and many assumptions that he used to try and quantify this, he was actually saying in a recent blog that he posted that the effect of closing schools, what would that mean? Because, I mean, closing schools, as Gontran say, would be my way of kind of trying to contain the spread of the virus. But that has got an economic cost that can be actually very significant. The closing of schools has a magnifying effect that is actually quite large, simply because if you close schools, you have to keep the parents at home, and that really stops production. And that's actually one of the things that is important for the discussion. To be clear, I mean, just like Gontran, I think health is the number one priority. We should be listening to what the health experts are saying. And in fact, the health experts should be the ones driving the information flow as well as anything else. And the economics there is to make sure that to the extent that there are trade-offs, they're done effectively in order to try to achieve one result, and that is containing the virus.
In your opinion, has the reaction globally, perhaps politically and economically, has that been proportionate to the scale of the risk?
I mean, I think it is, yes, because you're not talking about what you see. You're talking about what can happen. And I think a pandemic and the speeds of spread, as Gontran said, they're really quite exponential, right? And, you know, you need to take measures now in order to contain that. And if you don't, the cost of not doing is enormous. So, you know, I think provided you try and maintain clear, precise information from authoritative sources, then, yes, that is a proportionate reaction to the pandemic that we're seeing.
And so compared to other disruptions to the global economy in recent history, how much should we expect this to hurt? Is this going to impact global GDP in a way that's very visible, that everybody experiences?
Yeah, I mean, again, the most recent estimates by the OECD talk about between 1 and 3 percentage points. I mean, that is significant in an environment of very low growth. But I think it's early days. We won't see the final effects till we really understand the kind of measures that we'll put in place to try and contain it. So I think it's early days, but I think it will be visible and I think it will be significant.
Perhaps just to add on this, I think there's really two issues here. One is this just a short V? So we have a bump down, the economy freezes, and then the economy starts again. So it's basically just a short interruption activity. That's a loss of GDP, right? I mean, any car that is not produced is not going to be produced afterwards. So there is clearly a loss, but it's a short-term V. Or is this something that sort of will linger on and the effects and the second-round effects will actually drive the economy downwards over a more prolonged period of time? And I think that's really the key question. And from an economic point, and you asked, is the response proportionate? I have to say, I don't really know whether the response was proportionate because it involves basically difficult judgments, ethical judgments about human lives also. And so was it? I mean, the response is so multifaceted that I find it difficult to answer that in general terms. But I mean, just on the proportionality, I mean, the Chinese government, for example, as we've read in a newspaper, has used artificial intelligence and the tracking of mobile phones to contain the spread. This is proportionate, perhaps, for a Chinese a way of doing things. I don't think it would be proportionate for a European point of view. But I mean, let me come back to the economics. I think on the economics, I think a key question is what is the economic response of public authorities, not the health response, but the response to the economic consequences of the health response. And there, it's basically my thinking here is what do the public authorities, the fiscal authorities, what can they do? How can they support those that are most affected by the crisis, right? I mean, so what about the individuals? What about companies that lose output, that lose revenues? How can you support those companies? I think these are very concrete questions that need to be answered, and I think they need to be answered in a very comprehensive way at this stage. I mean, it's not a little thing here. I mean, this is going to be major, and we are in Europe, I think, only at the beginning of the upwards sloping curve, so the more is going to come.
It's hard to set a precedent for these things when you don't know how significant the problem is going to be. I mean, it could be that in 3 months we've all forgotten about this, and at least in economic communities, we're all talking about completely different issues. But it could be something that lasts for a year or possibly more and triggers a huge crisis in the greater scheme of things. So if you could set a precedent whereby, oh, you know, we compensate anybody who's lost a job or we help any company that's in serious trouble because of this disaster. But that precedent might not survive if this grows out of proportion. So how do you set rules now? It's almost impossible, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's actually a really significant public policy problem. I mean, I do think you need to set up in a very pragmatic way sort of insurance funds on which individuals, self-employed individuals can draw. You need to support companies. I mean, in the German debate, there's the nice word Kurzarbeitergeld, which is basically money given from the state to companies to temporarily cover their social security expenses and even their salaries. I think these kind of schemes can be put in place and they are really helpful. But as you say, as it lasts longer, more and more this will become really a much broader macroeconomic issue because people will lose the job, companies will go out of business. And then in a sense, the supply side shock morphs into a demand side shock and the whole thing becomes much deeper and much more significant. And so I think one of the key policy questions now is to what extent do finance ministers in Europe, to what extent do they have to set up a sort of a backstop and say, look, I mean, we are here and, you know, we are going to provide a macroeconomically meaningful stimulus to the economy. At what stage does this have to be really a reality so that expectations don't spiral down? I think this is one big question now.
And it's not just that we don't know, but it's also, you know, the repercussions of our inaction or any action has got direct ethical implications. It's not that you can say, I don't close a school because the cost of closing that school is enormous. You can't easily say that because that has got direct implications on health. And so I think on top of the uncertainty, it is really the moral aspect of it. And here, actually, it's interesting to compare some of the measures that were taken in China by comparison to what Europe is doing, which is driven by very different philosophies of how you approach an issue. Containment there is very much about, you know, just isolating the virus. In Europe, it's very difficult to sort of close cities, and in order to just simply stop the spread. So there are big issues here that we have to sort of take a stand on that we don't, policymakers don't often have to do that. And that's an important constraint this time around.
Does history provide any kind of economic precedence with how to deal or how not to deal with a situation like this?
We've had pandemics before. Yeah. We certainly had pandemics before. I think the question is the scale of it. Do we understand the scale of it this time around? Because if the scale is different from other times, that also changes our reaction.
I mean, perhaps on the history, I mean, just to sort of walk our listeners a bit on some interesting historical episodes. I mean, one episode is, of course, the Spanish flu 1918. But I think an even more studied pandemic was the 1340 spread of the pest. And this has had a major impact on the future of Europe at the time. I mean, what it did is it killed a very significant part of the European population.
About half,
30, 40, 50%, depending on the country. And, you know, this major thing actually led to a massive reduction in inequality. And, you know, this reduction in inequality, in a sense, was then an important driver for subsequent movements, at least according to some historical research, such as the Renaissance, right, where, you know, the individual played a bigger role, well, because there was less hierarchy, less inequality. So these things have very long-term implications. Now, fortunately, we are not talking of the pest here. The mortality rates are much, much lower. But, of course, also here, there is the question, what is the sort of long-term impact of this? And I can think of at least two major implications, long-term implications beyond the short-term sort of business cycle thing that we discussed. The two big things, it seems to me, is one is how are companies going to change the way they structure and organize their business, right? I mean, so this, do they keep more stock to be less vulnerable to supply side shocks? Do they perhaps onshore production? Do they perhaps have specific contingency plans for these things? I mean, so there's a major. Do they perhaps move much more to the digital space and travel less? Right, do more teleconferencing. So this could really impact the way companies organize their work. But I think the bigger and the broader debate is, will these reactions be so significant that actually the way we think of globalization will actually change? And that's a debate we've had on this podcast a few weeks ago.
I was going to say that, while I don't think of the pest as an instrument for reducing inequality.
Well, it reduced it. I mean, it's not an instrument, but it did it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think pest is a good instrument for reducing inequality. I mean, that is interesting. And I think the behavioral part that Guntram went in the direction of is exactly an interesting one. We've seen cancellations of conferences everywhere in the past, certainly the past week, if not 2 weeks. And not only have been cancellations, but actually people started talking, do we actually need to travel? Why don't we just do it through Skype or find another way, which might have some unexpected also upsides, which is, of course, again, it's not an instrument for getting there, but it's giving us an opportunity to rethink other things as well. Early days.
There's a very good book by Walter Scheidel called The Great Leveler, which essentially argues that historically episodes like plagues, revolutions and wars have basically reset spiraling inequality more efficiently than anything else. But I want to ask you, just to help people understand the proportion of this, you said a 3% drop in global GDP. When was the last time global GDP fell by 3% in 1 year? And what does that look like for precarious economies and precarious businesses?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you go back to 2009, which was effectively the most recent big drop in GDP, you were talking about, depending on which country you're talking about, orders of magnitude of 5 percentage points of GDP in 1 year. That order of magnitude. So 3% is not very far from that. But again, it's also subject to containment. If measures are put in place to try and prevent that, it could actually make it much more milder than that. But yeah, the Great Financial Crisis, which was a completely different crisis to the one we're talking about here, this is much more a real type, real economy type of crisis, that would be a comparable size.
Perhaps one point to add very quickly is I think it's important here to realize this is a shock that really affects the most advanced economies, which is quite interesting, right? I mean, often crises happen in emerging market economies, in poor economies. Now here, it's China and it's basically the EU and it's going to be the US and perhaps South Korea. I mean, these countries.
Why is that?
So I think it has to do with probably, I mean, there I'm not a virologist, but my understanding, it has to do with, who's most vulnerable to this. My understanding is old people are more vulnerable to the coronavirus, and our societies are comparatively old. And my understanding is also that the virus actually survives better in cold climate than in warm climate, which probably suggests that, you know, Africa as a continent or even Latin America at this stage will be far less affected than the more advanced economies. And I mean, I saw someone very mechanically applying essentially the mortality rate as reported by the Chinese authorities to the demography of different countries. And if you look at this, you will actually see that because we are such old societies, the Italian society is an old society, the German one is old, the Japanese is old, even the Chinese is pretty old by now, you really see that our economies and our countries are relatively strongly impacted because we just have a lot of old people and therefore are much more vulnerable to this.
But of course, a lot of those people presumably aren't that economically active, the people most vulnerable.
Yeah, that's right. So I think the loss in terms of GDP doesn't come from the fact that the 80-year-old doesn't work anymore. He doesn't work anyway. The loss comes from the fact that the 80-year-old doesn't only need care, but in order to prevent that the 80-year-old gets it, we need to shut down schools and so on, which is I think still the right response. But I mean, there are the economic consequences, and I think the fascinating question is how to minimize the economic loss to the necessary health response that the epidemiologists and health specialists should drive, basically.
They're not economically actively, but they're socially very active, which means that they interact. And that, of course, is really a risk in the context of the problem we're talking about.
Yes, and they spend money as well because they have disposable income. So what are the tensions at the moment between policymakers in terms of, you know, concrete responses to this?
I mean, the issue is how do you contain the virus and what's it going to cost? This is the issue. And, first we need to agree of what types of measures would be important for containing the virus itself. And then we need to find the funds of it. In Europe, there's also a call for much more of a coordinated action. I mean, can countries do different? Can countries coordinate or can the countries pull funds together to try and help alleviate some of the repercussions of having to deal with this shock? These are the questions we'll be discussing here in Brussels, I'm sure, next week when the finance ministers come together. But I think for the moment, the important thing is to maintain a differentiated approach because the virus is not the same at the same level in every country. Italy and Belgium are in actually quite different parts of the curve, which means they need different responses. And Italy at this point also serves as a lesson for the rest of us to try and see what can we do as Italy is experimenting with measures. I think these are the things that are in the minds of the policymakers, and they are changing every day depending on the new information that is coming in.
There's this infamous Warren Buffett quote, which I'm going to probably butcher a bit, but where he basically says, oh, you know, when the tide goes out, you see who's actually wearing their swimming costume. Are we going to see a lot of what were actually unsustainable business models and unsustainable economic models being exposed and the actual exposure of those unsustainable models being blamed on the coronavirus?
Well, that's a very, very big and important question. And I guess the German in me would say this is the moral hazard question, right? I mean, if you provide insurance You provide insurance also to those that actually would have gone out of business anyway, even if there hadn't been a coronavirus. And so I think that the, one of the questions of how do you structure the schemes of providing support is, well, you still want to make sure that you don't just sort of beef up the ones without the swimming suit, right? While the ones with swimming suit, they actually don't draw on this because they anyway have enough liquidity and so on. So this question, I think, is a relevant question. At the same time, I have to say, you know, when the fire is burning, you don't say, I don't end the fire and don't send the fire brigade. So as always, the moral hazard argument is there. But do you really have a lot of choice in a situation like this? That's, I think, one question that one has to really discuss.
Yeah, because on the other hand, you know, what you don't want is productive businesses to go bust simply because, you know, they didn't have the liquidity, as it were, to try and maintain for, you know, think about small mama and papa shops or restaurants that simply people don't go to restaurants. And the, otherwise, they're productive businesses, but, you know, because of this, they have to go bust. And this is why I think, and of course, the other side of the argument is Guntram's point, where, you know, you don't also want to help companies that maybe would be better off if they didn't survive. So that's why I don't think indiscriminate measures can be helpful here. I think it pays to put some effort to try and target measures, find those who are vulnerable, economically vulnerable, I mean, at this stage, and try and help those rather than just do indiscriminate measures that are just going to necessarily not reach those who need it the most and perhaps help those who might not deserve.
So before we go, let's just quickly talk about treatment, because you were saying earlier that this, let's say this is a 3% drop in global GDP. The last financial crisis was a 5% drop, so this is smaller but still extremely significant. Just, I know this is a very different type of crisis, but it still could cause a downturn which would have a lot of the same symptoms as the last one. So what have we learned about treating a downturn and how we react to that? How might we do things differently this time? What did we do wrong in the aftermath of the last crisis that might make people's life better within a recession, within the context of a long-term recession?
That's not a simple question, right? I mean, there are very different crises here. I mean, in 2008, we were talking about banks and the regulating banks and how is that going to strengthen the robustness of the system. Here we are talking about saving lives, and saving lives might mean we have to throw a lot of money at the problem. And you know, you cannot not do it if the end point is going to save lives, you see. So I think the frame of mind with which we come into problems is a big thing. One thing I think that it's important in all crises, and this one in particular, is timeliness. Quick response, don't procrastinate, take decisions immediately. Try to contain the timing of this effect, how long it would last. This is, I think, perhaps something that should be driving our thinking right now. Make it last for as little as possible and throw money at the problem early on. Perhaps I would here disagree a little bit with Guntram and say, if there is a moral hazard risk, let's just take it now. Because I think I would be prepared to do a type 1 error versus a type 2 error, simply because there are lives here.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would probably phrase it the other way around. I think I would ensure the economy as a whole and do some targeted measures, but I think there's just also need for some generous support to the economy, exactly because it avoids the moral hazard issue. The more you target measures, the more it becomes basically a moral hazard issue, because you target the weak, but some weak are actually weak, not because of coronavirus, but, you know, the little restaurant around the corner would have gone out of business anyway. Next month would have been anyway without liquidity. Now this has only accelerated the thing. And now I'm propping up this little business, which is basically throwing good money after bad. So I think, yes, there's need for targeted support for specific companies. But I think we will very soon be at the point where there is actually need to support the economy in general. And I this is not a monetary policy issue. I think monetary policy can do a bit. But, you know, at the end of the day, the ECB is already at the end of what they can do. They can provide a bit of liquidity. But it's really a fiscal issue. And so I think for me, the question of how do fiscal policy responses across the Eurozone in particular get coordinated, and how quickly they can agree on some support, general support, to beef up the economy. I think this will be, for me, one of the central questions. And we are actually working and thinking a lot about this, and we'll come out with a piece very soon.
Hmm. Well, I suppose what I was asking, or what I was getting at, is that if we know there's a recession coming, if we know we're going to experience that, how can we maybe just make life bearable in the aftermath that we know is going to happen, that we didn't 10 years ago, and obviously led to a lot of political resentment for the decade ahead. Have we learned anything about?
Well, but I mean, I would say, I mean, the response to the 2008-09 crisis was actually pretty good. I mean, where we had a problem in the Eurozone in particular was the 2011 crisis, which was, in a sense, a self-inflicted crisis because of, you know, the double dip recession as a result of excessive austerity in 2010 and 11 and so on and so forth. So I think, in a sense, I quite agree with Maria. This crisis is different in the sense it's a supply-side shock that then morphs into, in the real economy, that then morphs into demand-side problems, right? And so on the supply side, you know, a car that's not produced, you can't make that up. I mean, this GDP is just lost, right? But what you can make up for is the second round effects, which are basically then demand effects. And there, the macro authorities, the fiscal authorities are needed and can provide support to the economy.
I mean, if I may, despite whether the responses to the previous crisis were correct or not, I think there is a general, certainly in the Eurozone, I think there is a general feel that the response came too late. If you think about the QE of anything like that. And I think on a number of things, we could have done things quicker. And I'm saying that this time around, let's just please do things quicker, simply because, you know, the cost of not doing something is much bigger.
Great. Well, I think we'll leave it there for now. Thank you, Guntram Wolf. Thank you, Maria Demirtsis. And thank you very much for listening. Do visit Bruegel.org, where we'll be covering this topic in length.
I just wanted to thank our editor of the Sound of Economics, Nicholas. This is the last time that you're hosting this show. Thank you very much for developing this into a wonderful product, and we wish you the best of luck back in your own country.
Oh, well, thank you very much. But we do have a couple of episodes saved up, so I won't be disappearing from the Bruegel airwaves just yet. So there's a couple more Nicholas episodes to come. But this is the last one recording.
This is the last one recorded. Thank you, Nicholas.
And this is my last day, and I've got about 30 minutes left at Bruegel. But Bruegel will continue to exist, and they will continue to publish articles about the coronavirus and much, much more at Bruegel.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And look out for our new newsletter, The Y-Axis, which I think you're going to really like. Goodbye.